and sent him staggering right out of the circle, folk on the front row of stone benches scattering like starlings. Golden came after him, spewing curses, raining blows, fists knocking Lamb left and right like he was made of rags. The old man's hands dropped, face slack, eyes glassy, and Golden knew the moment was come. He stepped in, swinging with all his strength, and landed the father of all punches right on the point of Lamb's jaw. He watched the old man stumble, fists dangling, waiting for Lamb's knees to buckle so he could spring on top of him and put an end to it. But Lamb didn't fall. He tottered back a pace or two into the circle and stood swaying, blood drooling from his open mouth, and his face tipped into shadow. Then Golden caught something over the thunder of the crowd, soft and low, but there was no mistaking it. The old man was laughing. Golden stood, chest heaving, legs weak, arms heavy from his efforts, and he felt a chill doubt wash over him, because he wasn't sure he could hit a man any harder than that.
"Who are you?"
he roared, fists aching like he'd been beating a tree. Lamb gave a smile like an open grave, and stuck out his red tongue and smeared blood from it across his cheek in long streaks. He held up his left fist and gently uncurled it, so he looked at Golden, eyes wide and weeping wet like two black tar pits through the gap where his middle finger used to be. The crowd had fallen eerily quiet, and Golden's doubt turned to a sucking dread, because he finally knew the old man's name.
"By the dead," he whispered. "It can't be."
But he knew it was. However fast, however strong, however fearsome you make yourself, there's always someone faster, stronger, more fearsome, and the more you fight, the sooner you'll meet him. No one cheats the great leveler forever. And now Glamour Golden felt the sweat turn cold on him, and the fire inside guttered out and left only ashes. And he knew this would be his last fight indeed.
"So fucking unfair," Cantlis muttered to himself.
All that effort spent dragging those mewling brats across the far country, all that risk taken bringing them to the dragon people, every bit repaid and interest too, and what thanks? Just Papa Ring's endless moaning, and another shitty task to get through besides. However hard he worked, things never went his way.
"A man just can't get a fair go,"
he snapped at nothing, and saying it made his face hurt, and he gingerly pressed the scratches, and that made his hand hurt, and he reflected bitterly on the wrong-headed stupidity of womankind. "After everything I'd done for that whore." That idiot Warp was pretending to read as Cantlis stalked around the corner.
"Get up, idiot!"
The woman was still in the cage, still tied and helpless, but she was watching him in a style made him angrier than ever, level and steady, like she'd something on her mind other than fear, like she'd a plan and he was a piece of it.
"What do you think you're looking at, bitch?"
he snapped. Clear and cold, she said.
"A fucking coward."
He stopped short, blinking, hardly able to believe it at first. Even this skinny thing disrespecting him? Even this who should have been snivelling for mercy? If you can't get a woman's respect tying her up and beating her, when can you fucking get it?
"What?"
he whispered, going cold all over. She leaned forwards, mocking eyes on him all the way, curled her lips back, pressed her tongue into the gap between her teeth, and with a jerk of her head spat across the cage and through the bars, and it spattered against Cantlis's new shirt.
"Coward cunt," she said.
Taking a telling from Papa Ring was one thing. This was another.
"Get that cage open,"
he snarled, near choking on fury.
"Right, yeah."
Warp was fumbling with his ring of keys, trying to find the right one. There were only three on there. Cantliss tore it out of his hand, jammed the key in the lock, and ripped back the gate, edge clanging against the wall and taking a chunk out of it.
"I'll learn you a fucking lesson!" he screamed,
but the woman watched him still, teeth bared and breathing so hard he could see the specks of spit off her lips. He caught a twisted handful of her shirt, half-lifting her, stitches ripping, and he clamped his other hand around her jaw, crushing her mouth between his fingers like he'd crush her face to pulp, and agony lanced up his thigh, and he gave a whooping shriek. Another jolt, and his leg gave, so he tottered against the wall.
"What you—"
said Warp, and Cantliss heard scuffling and grunting, and he twisted around, only just staying on his feet for the pain right up into his groin. Warp was against the cage, face a picture of stupid surprise, the woman holding him up with one hand and punching him in the gut with the other. With each punch she gave a spitty snort, and he gave a cross-eyed gurgle, and Cantliss saw she had a knife, strings of blood slopping off it and spattering the floor as she stabbed him. Cantliss realized she'd stabbed him, too, and he gave a whimper of outrage at the hurt and injustice of it, took one hopping step and flung himself at her, caught her around the back, and they tumbled through the cage door and crashed together onto the packed dirt floor outside, the knife bouncing away. She was slippery as a trout, though, slithered out on top and gave him a couple of hard punches in the mouth, snapping his head against the ground before he knew where he was. She lunged for the knife, but he caught her shirt before she got there and dragged her back, ragged thing ripped half off, the pair of them wriggling across the dirt floor towards the table, grunting and spitting. She punched him again, but it only caught the top of his skull, and he tangled his hand in her hair and dragged her head sideways. She squealed and thrashed, but he had her now and smacked her skull into the leg of the table. And again, and she went limp long enough for him to drag his weight on top of her, groaning as he tried to use his stabbed leg, all wet and warm now from his leaking blood. He could hear her breath whooping in her throat as they twisted and strained, and she kneed at him, but his weight was on her, and he finally got his forearm across her neck and started pressing on it, shifted his body and reached out, stretching with his fingers, and gathered in the knife. And he chuckled as his hand closed around it because he knew he'd won.
"Now we'll fucking see," he hissed,
a bit messed up with his lips split and swollen, and he lifted the blade so she got a good look at it, her face all pinked from lack of air, with bloody hair stuck across it, and her bulging eyes followed the point as she strained at his arm, weaker and weaker, and he brought the knife high, did a couple of fake little stabs to taunt her, enjoying the way her face twitched each time.
"Now we'll see."
He brought it higher still to do the job for real. And Cantliss's wrist was suddenly twisted right around, and he gasped as he was dragged off her. And as he was opening his mouth, something smashed into it and sent everything spinning. He shook his head, could hear the woman coughing, what sounded like a long way away. He saw the knife on the ground, reached for it. A big boot came down and smashed his hand into the dirt floor. Another swung past, and its toe flicked the blade away. Cantliss groaned and tried to move his hand, but couldn't.
"You want me to kill him?"
asked an old man, looking down.
"No,"
croaked the girl, stooping for the knife.
"I want to kill him."
And she took a step at Cantliss, spitting blood in his face through the gap between her teeth.
"No,"
he whimpered, trying to scramble back with his useless leg, but still with his useless hand pinned under the old man's boot.
"You need me. You want your children back, right? Right?"
He saw her face and knew he had a chink to pick at.
"Ain't easy getting up there. I can show you the ways. You need me. I'll help. I'll put it right. Wasn't my fault. It was Ring. He said he'd kill me. I didn't have no choice. You need me."
And he blathered and wept and begged, but felt no shame. Because when he's got no other choice, a sensible man begs like a bastard.
"What a thing is this,"
muttered the old-timer, lip curled with contempt. The girl came back from the cage with the rope she'd been bound with.
"Best keep her options open, though,"
Take him with us?
She squatted down and gave Cantlis a red smile.
We can always kill him later.
Abram Mahood was deeply concerned, not about the result, for that no longer looked in doubt, about what would come after. With each exchange, Golden grew weaker. His face, as far as could be told through the blood and swelling, was a mask of fear. Lamb's smile, by terrible contrast, split wider with every blow given or received. It had become the demented leer of a drunkard, of a lunatic, of a demon. No trace remaining of the man Mahood had laughed with on the plains, an expression so monstrous that observers in the front row scrambled back onto the benches behind whenever Lamb lurched close. The audience was turning almost as ugly as the show. Mahood dreaded to imagine the total value of wagers in the balance, and he had already seen fights break out among the spectators. The sense of collective insanity was starting to remind him strongly of a battle, a place he had very much hoped never to visit again. And in a battle, he knew there are always casualties. Lamb sent Golden reeling with a heavy right hand, caught him before he fell, hooked a finger in his mouth, and ripped his cheek wide open, blood spotting the nearest onlookers.
"Oh my," said Kernsbeck, watching the fight through his spread fingers. "We should go."
But Mahood saw no easy way to manage it. Lamb had hold of Golden's arm, was wrapping his own around it, forcing him onto his knees, the pinned hand flopping uselessly. Mahood heard Golden's bubbling scream, then the sharp pop as his elbows snapped back the wrong way, skin horribly distended around the joint. Lamb was on him like a wolf on the kill, giggling as he seized Golden around the throat, arching back and smashing his forehead into his face, and again, the crowd whooping their joy or dismay at the outcome. Mahood heard a wail, saw bodies heaving in the stands, what looked like two men stabbing another. The sky was suddenly lit by a bloom of orange flame, bright enough almost to feel the warmth of. A moment later, a thunderous boom shook the arena, and terrified onlookers flung themselves down, hands clasped over their heads, screams of bloodlust turned to howls of dismay. A man staggered into the circle, clutching at his guts, and fell not far from where Lamb was still intent on smashing Golden's head apart with his hands. Fire leapt and twisted in the drizzle on Papa Ring's side of the street. A fellow not two strides away was hit in the head by a piece of debris as he stood and knocked flying.
"Explosive powder," muttered Kernsbeck,
his eyeglasses alive with the reflections of fire. Mahood seized him by the arm and dragged him along the bench. Between the heaving bodies, he could see Lamb's hacked-out smile, lit by one guttering torch, beating someone's head against one of the pillars with a regular crunch, crunch, the stone smeared black. Mahood had a suspicion the victim was Camling. The time for referees was plainly long past.
"Oh my," muttered Kernsbeck. "Oh my."
Mahood drew his sword, the one General Malzegert had given him as thanks for saving his life. He hated the damn thing, but was glad of it now. Man's ingenuity has still developed no better tool for getting people out of the way than a length of sharpened steel. Excitement had devolved into panic with the speed of a mudslide. On the other side of the circle, the new-built stand was starting to rock alarmingly as people boiled down it, trampling each other in their haste to get away. With a tortured creak, the whole structure lurched sideways, buckling, spars splintering like matchsticks, twisting, falling, people pitching over the poorly made railings and tumbling through the darkness. Mahood dragged Kernsbeck through it all, ignoring the fighting, the injured, a woman propped on her elbows staring at the bones sticking out of her leg. It was every man for himself, and perhaps if they were lucky, those closest to him, no choice but to leave the rest to God.
"Oh my," burbled Kernsbeck.
In the street, it was no longer like a battle, it was one. People dashed gibbering through the madness, lit by the spreading flames on ringside of the street. Blades glinted, men clashed and fell and rolled, floundered in the stream, the sides impossible to guess. He saw someone toss a burning bottle whirling onto a roof, where it shattered, curling lines of fire shooting across the thatch and catching hungrily in spite of the wet. He glimpsed the mayor, still staring across the maddened street from her balcony. She pointed at something, spoke to a man beside her, calmly directing. Mahood acquired the strong impression that she had never intended to sit back and meekly abide by the result. Arrows flickered in the darkness, one stuck in the mud near them burning. Mahood's ears rang with words screeched in languages he did not know. There was another thunderous detonation, and he cowered as timbers span high, smoke roiling up into the wet sky. Someone had a woman by the hair, was dragging her kicking through the muck. "Oh my," said Kernsvik over and over. A hand clutched at Mahood's ankle, and he struck out with the flat of his sword, tore free and struggled on, not looking back, sticking to the porches of the buildings on the mayor's side of the street. High above, at the top of the nearest column, three men were silhouetted, two with bows, a third lighting their pitch-soaked arrows so they could calmly shoot them at the houses across the way. The building with the sign that said Fuck Palace was thoroughly ablaze. A woman leapt from the balcony and crumpled in the mud, wailing. Two corpses lay nearby. Four men stood with naked swords watching. One was smoking a pipe. Mahood thought he was a dealer from the mayor's Church of Dice. Kernsvik tried to pull his arm free.
"We should—" "No," snapped Mahood, dragging him on. "We shouldn't."
Mercy, along with all the trappings of civilized behavior, was a luxury they could ill afford. Mahood dragged out the key to their shop and thrust it into Kernsvik's trembling hand while he faced the street, sword up.
"Oh my," the inventor was saying as he struggled with the lock. "Oh my."
They spilled inside into the still safety, the darkness of the shop flickering with slashes of orange and yellow and red. Mahood shouldered the door shut, gasped with relief as he felt the latch drop, spun about when he felt a hand on his shoulder, and nearly took Temple's head off with his flailing sword.
"What the hell's going on?"
A strip of light wandered across one half of Temple's stricken face.
"Who won the fight?"
Mahood put the point of his sword on the floor and leaned on the pommel, breathing hard.
"Lam tore Golden apart, literally."
"Oh my," whimpered Kernsvik, sliding down the wall until his arse thumped against the floor.
"What about Chai?"
asked Temple.
"I've no idea. I've no idea about anything."
Mahood eased the door open a crack to peer out.
"But I suspect the mayor is cleaning house."
The flames on Papa Ring's side of the street were lighting the whole town in garish colors. The White House was ablaze to its top floor, fire shooting into the sky, ravenous, murderous, trees burning on the slopes above, ash and embers fluttering in the rain.
"Shouldn't we help?"
whispered Temple.
"A good man of business remains neutral."
"Surely there's a moment to cease being a good man of business and try to be merely a good man."
"Perhaps."
Mahood heaved the door shut again.
"But this is not that moment."
Old Friends.
"Well then," shouted Papa Ring, and he swallowed and he blinked into the sun. "Here we are, I guess."
There was a sheen of sweat across his forehead, but Temple could hardly blame him for that.
"I haven't always done right."
Someone had ripped the ring from his ear, and the distorted lobe flopped loose as he turned his head.
"Dare say, most of you won't miss me none. But I've always done my best to keep my word, at least. You'd have to say, I always kept my—"
Temple heard the mayor snap her fingers, and her man booted Ring in the back and sent him lurching off the scaffold. The noose jerked tight, and he kicked and twisted, rope creaking, as he did the hanged man's dance, piss running from one of his dirty trouser legs. Little men and big, brave men and cowards, powerful men and meagre, they all hang very much the same. That made 11 of them dangling. Ring and 9 of his henchmen, and the woman who had been in charge of his whores. A half-hearted cheer went up from the crowd, more habit than enthusiasm. Last night's events had more than satisfied even Creese's appetite for death.
"And that's the end of that," said the mayor under her breath.
"It's the end of a lot," said Temple. One of the ancient pillars the White House had stood between had toppled in the heat. The other loomed strangely naked, cracked and soot-blackened, the ruins of the present tangled, charred about the ruins of the past. A good half of the buildings on Ring's side of the street had met the same fate, yawning gaps burned from the jumble of wooden shack and shanty, scavengers busy among the wreckage.
"We'll rebuild," said the mayor. "That's what we do. Is that treaty ready yet?"
"Very nearly done," Temple managed to say.
"Good. That piece of paper could save a lot of lives."
"I see that saving lives is our only concern." He trudged back up the steps without waiting for a reply. He shed no tears for Papa Ring, but he had no wish to watch him kick any longer. With a fair proportion of the town's residents dead by violence, fire, or hanging, a large number run off, a still larger number even now preparing to leave, and most of the rest in the street observing the conclusion of the great feud, the mayor's Church of Dice was eerily empty, Temple's footsteps echoing around the smoke-stained rafters. Dab Sweet, Crying Rock, and Corlin sat about one table playing cards under the vacant gaze of the ancient armor ranged about the walls.
"Not watching the hanging?"
asked Temple. Corlin glanced at him out of the corner of her eye and treated him to a hiss of contempt. More than likely, she had heard the story of his naked dash across the street.
"Nearly got hanged myself one time, up near Hope," said Sweet. "Turned out a misunderstanding, but even so."
The old scout hooked a finger in his collar and dragged it loose.
"Strangled my enthusiasm for the business."
"Bad luck,"
intoned Crying Rock, seeming to stare straight through her cards, half of which faced in and the other half out. Whether it was the end of Sweet's enthusiasm, or his near hanging, or hanging in general that was bad luck, she didn't clarify. She was not a woman prone to clarification.
"And when there's death outside, is the one time a man can get some room in here."
Sweet rocked his chair back on two legs and deposited his dirty boot on the table.
"I reckon this place has turned sour. Soon there'll be more money in taking folk away than bringing them in. Just need to round up a few miserable failures desperate to see civilization again, and we're on our way back to the near country."
"Maybe I'll join you," said Temple.
A crowd of failures sounded like ideal company for him.
"Always welcome."
Crying Rock let fall a card and started to rake in the pot, her face just as slack as if she'd lost. Sweet tossed his hand away in disgust.
20 years I've been losing to this cheating bloody ghost, and she still pretends she don't know how to play the game."
Savien and Lamb stood at the counter, warming themselves at a bottle. Shorn of hair and beard, the Northman looked younger, even bigger, and a great deal meaner. He also looked as if he had made every effort to fell a tree with his face. It was a misshapen mass of scab and bruise, a ragged cut across one cheekbone roughly stitched, and his hands both wrapped in stained bandages.
"All the same," he was grunting through bloated lips, "I owe you big." "Dare say I'll find a way for you to pay," answered Savien. "Where do you stand on politics?" "These days, as far away from it as I can."
They shut up tight when they saw Temple.
"Where's Shy?"
he asked. Lamb looked at him,
one eye swollen nearly shut and the other infinitely tired. Upstairs in the mayor's rooms.
Will she see me?
That's up to her.
Temple nodded.
You've got my thanks as well, he said to Savion, for what that's worth. We all give what we can.
Temple wasn't sure whether that was meant to sting.
It was one of those moments when everything stung.
He left the two old men and made for the stairs. Behind him he heard Savion mutter, I'm talking about the rebellion in Starikland. The one just finished? That and the next one.
He lifted his fist outside the door and paused. There was nothing to stop him letting it drop and riding straight out of town, to Burmese claim, maybe, or even on to somewhere no one knew what a disappointing cock he was. If there was any such place left in the circle of the world. Before the impulse to take the easy way could overwhelm him, he made himself knock. Shai's face looked little better than Lamb's, scratched and swollen, nose cut across the bridge, neck a mass of bruises. It hurt him to see it. Not as much as if he'd taken the beating, of course, but it hurt still. She didn't look upset to see him. She didn't look that interested. She left the door open, limping slightly, and showed her teeth as she sank down on a bench under the window, bare feet looking very white against the floorboards.
"How was the hanging?"
she asked. He stepped inside and gently pushed the door to.
"Very much like they always are.
Can't say I've ever understood their appeal. Perhaps it makes people feel like winners, seeing someone else lose so hard."
"Losing hard, I know all about."
"Are you all right?" She looked up, and he could hardly meet her eye.
"Bit sore."
"You're angry with me." He sounded like a sulking child.
"I'm not. I'm just sore."
"What good would I have done if I'd stayed?" She licked at her split lip.
"I dare say you'd just have got yourself killed."
"Exactly. But instead, I ran for help."
"You ran, all right. That I can corroborate."
"I got Savion.
And Savion got me. Just in time."
"That's right.
That's right."
She held her side as she slowly fished up one boot and started to pull it on.
"So I guess what we're saying is, I owe you my life."
"Thanks, Temple. You're a fucking hero. Next time I see a bare ass vanishing out my window, I'll know to just lie back and await salvation." They looked at each other in silence, while outside in the street, the hanging crowd started to drift away. Then he sank into a chair facing her.
"I'm fucking ashamed of myself."
"That's a great comfort. I'll use your shame as a poultice on my grazes.
I've got no excuse.
And yet I feel one's coming." His turn to grimace.
"I'm a coward. Simple as that. I've been running away so long it's come to be a habit. Not easy, changing old habits. However much we might..."
"Don't bother." She gave a long, pained sigh.
"I got low expectations. To be fair, you already exceeded them once when you paid your debt. So you tend to the cowardly. Who doesn't? You ain't the brave knight, and I ain't the swooning maiden, and this ain't no storybook, that's for sure. You're forgiven. You can go your way."
And she waved him out the door with the scabbed back of her hand. That was closer to forgiveness than he could have hoped for, but he found he was not moving.
"I don't want to go."
"I'm not asking you to jump again. You can use the stairs."
"Let me make it right."
She looked up at him from under her brows.
"We're heading into the mountains, Temple. That bastard Cantlis will show us where these dragon people are, and we're going to try and get my brother and sister back. And I can't promise there'll be anything made right at all. A few promises I can make. It'll be hard and cold and dangerous, and there won't even be any windows to jump out of. You'll be about as useful there as a spent match, and let's neither one of us offend honesty by pretending otherwise." Please. He took a wheedling step towards her. Please, give me one more.
Leave me be,
she said, narrowing her eyes at him.
I just want to sit and hurt in peace.
So that was all. Maybe he should have fought harder, but Temple had never been much of a fighter. So he nodded at the floor and quietly shut the door behind him and went back down the steps and over to the counter.
"Get what you wanted?" asked Lamb.
"No," said Temple, spilling a pocketful of coins across the wood. "What I deserved." And he started drinking. He was vaguely aware of the dull thud of hooves out in the street, shouting, and the jingle of harness. Some new fellowship pulling into town, some new set of forthcoming disappointments. But he was too busy with his own even to bother to look up. He told the man behind the counter to leave the bottle. This time there was no one else to blame. Not God, not Koska, certainly not Shy. Lamb had been right. The trouble with running is, wherever you run to, there you are. Temple's problem was Temple, and it always had been. He heard heavy footsteps, spurs jingling, calls for drink and women, but he ignored them, inflicted another burning glassful on his gullet, banged it down, eyes watering, reached for the bottle. Someone else got there first.
"You'd best leave that be," growled Temple.
"How would I drink it, then?"
At the sound of that voice, a terrible chill prickled his spine. His eyes crawled to the hand on the bottle, aged, liver-spotted, dirt beneath the cracked nails, a gaudy ring upon the first finger. His eyes crawled past the grubby lacework on the sleeve, up the mud-spotted material, over the breastplate, gilt peeling, up a scrawny neck speckled with rash, and to the face. That awfully familiar, hollowed visage. The nose sharp, the eyes bright, the greyed moustaches waxed to curling points.
"Oh, God," breathed Temple.
"Close enough," said Nicomo Koska,
and delivered that luminous smile of which only he was capable, good humour and good intentions radiating from his deep-lined face.
"Look who it is, boys!"
At least two dozen well-known and deeply detested figures had made their way in after the old man.
"Whatever are the odds?"
asked Braccio, showing his yellow teeth. He had a couple fewer knives in his bandolier than when Temple had left the company, but was otherwise unchanged.
"Rejoice, ye faithful!"
rumbled Joubert, quoting scripture in Cantic,
"for the wanderer returns."
"Scouting, were you?" sneered Dimbic, smoothing his hair down with a licked finger and straightening his sash, which had devolved into a greasy tatter of indeterminate colour. "Finding us a path to glory?"
"Ah, a drink, a drink, a drink."
Koska took a long and flamboyant swig from Temple's bottle.
"Did I not tell you all? Wait long enough, and things have a habit of returning to their proper place. Having lost my company, I was for some years a penniless wanderer, buffeted by the winds of fate, most roughly buffeted, Swarbrick, make a note of that."
The writer, whose hair had grown considerably wilder, clothes shabbier, nostril rims pinker and hands more tremulous since they last met, fumbled for his pencil.
"But here I am, once more in command of a band of noble fighting men. You will scarcely believe it, but Sergeant Friendly was at one time forced into the criminal fraternity."
The necklace sergeant hoisted one brow a fraction.
"But he now stands beside me as the staunch companion he was born to be. And you, Temple, what role could fit your high talents and low character so well as that of my legal adviser?"
Temple hopelessly shrugged.
"None that I can think of."
"Then let us celebrate our inevitable reunion. One for me."
The old man took another hefty swig, then grinned as he poured the smallest dribble of spirit into Temple's glass.
And one for you.
I thought you stopped drinking.
It felt like a perfect moment to start again,
croaked Temple. He had been expecting Kosker to order his death, but, almost worse, it appeared the company of the Gracious Hand would simply reabsorb him without breaking stride. If there was a god, he had clearly taken a set dislike to Temple over the past few years. But Temple supposed he could hardly blame him. He was coming to feel much the same.
"Gentlemen, welcome to Crease." The mayor came sweeping through the doorway. "I must apologize for the mess, but we have..."
She saw the old man, and her face drained of all color. The first time Temple had seen her even slightly surprised.
"Nicomo Kosker,"
she breathed.
"None other. You must be the mayor."
He stiffly bowed, then looking slyly up, added,
"These days... it is a morning of reunions, apparently."
"You know each other?" asked Temple.
"Well," muttered the mayor, "what astonishing luck." "They do say luck is a woman."
The old man made Temple grunt by poking him in the ribs with the neck of his own bottle.
"She's drawn to those who least deserve her."
Out of the corner of his eye, Temple saw Shy limping down the stairs and over towards Lamb, who, along with Savion, was watching the new arrivals in careful silence. Kosker, meanwhile, was strutting to the windows, spurs jingling. He took a deep breath, apparently savouring the odour of charred wood, and started to swing his head gently in time to the creaking of the bodies on their scaffold.
"I love what you've done with the place," he called to the mayor. "Very apocalyptic. You make something of a habit of leaving settlements you preside over in smoking ruins."
Something they had in common, as far as Temple could tell. He realized he was picking at the stitches holding his buttons on and forced himself to stop.
"Are these gentlemen your whole contingent?" asked the mayor, eyeing the filthy, squinting, scratching, spitting mercenaries slouching about her gaming hall.
"Dear me, no! We lost a few on the way across the far country. The inevitable desertions, a round of fever, a little trouble with the ghosts. But these stalwarts are but a representative sample. I have left the rest beyond the city limits, because if I were to bring some 300...
260,
said Friendly. The mayor looked paler yet at the number.
"Counting Inquisitor Lawson and his practicals?"
268.
At the mention of the Inquisition, the mayor's face had turned positively deathly.
"If I were to bring 268 travel-sore fighting men into a place like this, there would frankly be carnage."
"And not the good sort,"
threw in Braccio, dabbing at his weepy eye.
"There is a good sort," murmured the mayor.
Kosker thoughtfully worked the tip of one moustache between thumb and forefinger.
"There are degrees, anyway. And here he is."
His black coat was weather-worn, a patchy yellow-grey beard had sprouted from cheeks more gaunt than ever, but Inquisitor Lawson's eyes were just as bright with purpose as they had been when the company left Mulkova. More so, if anything.
"This is Inquisitor Lawson,"
Kosker scratched thoughtfully at his rashy neck.
"My current employer."
"An honor,"
though Temple detected the slightest strain in the mayor's voice.
"If I may ask, what business might His Majesty's Inquisition have in Crease?"
"We are hunting escaped rebels," called Lawson to the room at large. "Traitors to the Union."
"We are far from the Union here."
The Inquisitor's smile seemed to chill the whole room.
"The reach of His Eminence lengthens yearly. Large rewards are being offered for the capture of certain persons.
A list will be posted throughout town. At its head, the traitor, murderer, and chief fomenter of rebellion, Conthus. Savion gave vent to a muffled round of coughing, and Lamb slapped him on the back, but Lawson was too busy frowning down his nose at Temple to notice. I see you have been reunited with this slippery liar.
Come now.
Koska gave Temple's shoulder a fatherly squeeze.
A degree of slipperiness, and indeed of lying, is a positive boon in a notary. Beneath it all, there has never been a man of such conscience and moral courage. I'd trust him with my life, or at least my hat.
And he swept it off and hung it over Temple's glass.
As long as you trust him with none of my business.
Lawson waved to his practicals.
Come, we have questions to ask.
He seems charming, said the mayor, as she watched him leave.
Koska scratched at his rash again and held up his fingernails to assess the results.
The Inquisition makes a point of recruiting only the most well-mannered fanatical torturers.
And the most foul-mannered old mercenaries, too, it would appear.
A job is a job, but I have my own reasons for being here also. I came looking for a man called Gregor Cantlis.
There was a long pause as that name settled upon the room like a chilly snowfall.
Fuck, he heard Shy breathe.
Koska looked about expectantly.
He has at times passed through.
The mayor had the air of choosing her words very carefully.
If you were to find him, what then?
Then I and my notary, not to mention my employer, the noble Inquisitor Lawson, could be very much out of your way. Mercenaries have, I am aware, a poor reputation, but believe me when I say we are not here to cause trouble.
He swilled some spirit lazily around in the bottom of the bottle.
Why, do you have some notion of Cantlis's whereabouts?
A pregnant silence ensued while a set of long glances were exchanged. Then Lamb slowly lifted his chin. Shai's face hardened. The mayor graced them with the tiniest apologetic shrug.
He is chained up in my cellar.
Bitch, breathed Shai.
Cantlis is ours.
Lamb pushed himself up from the counter and stood tall, bandaged left hand sitting loose on the hilt of his sword. Several of the mercenaries variously puffed themselves up and found challenging stances of one kind or another, like tomcats opening hostilities in a moonlit alley. Friendly only watched, dead-eyed, dice clicking in his fist as he worked them gently around each other.
Yours?
Asked Koska.
He burned my farm and stole my son and daughter and sold them to some savages. We've tracked him all the way from the near country. He's going to take us up into the mountains and show us where these dragon people are.
The old man's body might have stiffened down the years, but his eyebrows were still some of the most limber in the world, and they reached new heights now.
Dragon people, you say? Perhaps we can help each other.
Lamb glanced about the dirty, scarred, and bearded faces.
Guess you can never have too many allies.
Quite so. A man lost in the desert must take such water as he is offered, eh, Temple?
Not sure I wouldn't rather go thirsty, muttered Shai.
I'm Lamb. That's Shai.
The Northman raised his glass, the stump of his middle finger plainly visible in spite of the bandages.
A nine-fingered Northman, mused the Captain General. I do believe a fellow called Shivers was looking for you in the near country.
Haven't seen him.
Ah.
Koska waved his bottle at Lamb's injuries.
I thought perhaps this might be his handiwork.
No.
You appear to have many enemies, Master Lamb.
Sometimes it seems I can't shit without making a couple more.
It all depends who you shit on, I suppose. A fearsome fellow, called Shivers, and I would not judge the years to have mellowed him. We knew each other back in Styria, he and I. Sometimes I feel I've met everyone in the world, and that every new place is peopled with old faces.
His considering gaze came to rest on Savion.
Although I do not recognize this gentleman.
I'm Savion,
and he coughed into his fist.
And what brings you to the far country? Your health?
Savion paused, mouth a little open, while an awkward silence stretched out, several of the mercenaries still with hands close to weapons, and suddenly Shai said,
Cantlis took one of his children, too. He's been tracking them along with us. Lad called Colum.
The silence lasted a little longer, then Savion added, almost reluctantly,
My lad, Colum.
He coughed again and raspingly cleared his throat,
hoping Cantlis can lead us to him.
It was almost a relief to see two of the mayor's men dragging the bandit across the gaming hall. His wrists were in manacles, his once fine clothes were stained rags, and his face as bruised as lamb's, one hand hanging useless and one leg dragging on the boards behind him.
The elusive Gregor Cantlis! Shouted Koska, as the mayor's men flung him cringing down. Fear not! I am Nicomo Koska, infamous soldier of fortune, etc., etc., and I have some questions for you. I advise you to consider your answers carefully, as your life may depend upon them, and so forth.
Cantlis registered Shai, Savion, Lam, and the score or more of mercenaries, and, with a coward's instinct, Temple well recognized, quickly perceived the shift in the balance of power. He eagerly nodded.
Some months ago you bought some horses in a town called Greya. You used coins like these.
Koska produced a tiny gold piece with a magician's flourish.
Antique imperial coins, as it happens.
Cantlis's eyes flickered over Koska's face as though trying to read a script.
I did. That's a fact.
You bought those horses from rebels fighting to free Starrick Land from the Union.
I did.
You did.
I did.
Koska leaned close.
Where did the coins come from?
Dragon people paid me with them, said Cantlis. Savages in the mountains up beyond Beacon.
Paid you for what?
He licked his scabbed lips.
For children. An ugly business, muttered Swarbrick.
Most business is, said Koska, leaning closer and closer towards Cantlis. They have more of these coins?
All I could ever want, that's what he said.
Who said?
Werdenur. He's their leader.
All I could ever want.
Koska's eyes glimmered as brightly as his imagined gold.
So, you are telling me these dragon people are in league with the rebels?
What?
That these savages are funding and perhaps harboring the rebel leader Conthus himself?
There was a silence while Cantlis blinked up.
Yes?
Koska smiled very wide.
Yes! And when my employer, Inquisitor Lawson, asks you the same question, what will your answer be?
Now Cantlis smiled too, sensing that his chances might have drastically improved.
Yes, they got them that Conthus up there, no doubt in my mind. Hell, he's more than likely going to use their money to start a new war.
I knew it!
Koska poured a measure of spirit into Lam's empty glass.
We must accompany you into the mountains and pull up this very root of insurrection. This wretched man will be our guide and thereby win his freedom.
Yes, indeed,
shouted Cantlis, grinning at Shai and Lam and Savion, then squawking as Braccio hauled him to his feet and manhandled him towards the door, wounded leg dragging.
Fuckers,
whispered Shai.
Realistic,
Lam hissed at her, one hand on her elbow.
What luck for all of us,
Koska was expounding,
that I should arrive as you prepare to leave.
Oh, I've always had the luck,
muttered Temple.
And me,
murmured Shai.
Realistic,
he
hissed Lamb.
"A party of four is easily dismissed,"
Koska was telling the room.
"A party of 300, so much less easily."
272,
said Friendly.
"If I could have a word."
Dab Sweet was approaching the counter.
"You're planning on heading into the mountains? You'll need a better scout than that half-dead killer. I stand ready and willing to offer my services."
"So generous," said Koska. "And you are?"
"Dab Sweet."
And the famous scout removed his hat to display his own thinning locks. Evidently he had caught the scent of a more profitable opportunity than shepherding the desperate back to Starikland.
"The noted frontiersman?" asked Sawbreck, looking up from his papers. "I thought you'd be younger."
Sweet sighed.
"I used to be."
"You're aware of him?"
asked Koska. The biographer pointed his nose towards the ceiling.
"A man by the name of Maren Glanhorm, I refuse to use the term writer in relation to him, has penned some most inferior and far-fetched works based upon his supposed exploits."
"Those were unauthorized," said Sweet. "But I've exploited a thing or two, that's true. I've trodden on every patch of this far country big enough to support a boot, and that includes them mountains."
He beckoned Koska closer, spoke softer.
"Almost as far as Ashrank, where those dragon people live. They're sacred ground.
My partner, Crying Rock, she's been even further. See?"
He gave a showman's pause.
"She used to be one of them."
"True,"
grunted Crying Rock, still occupying her place at the table, though Corlin had vanished, leaving only her cards.
"Raised up there," said Sweet. "Lived up there."
"Born up there, eh?"
asked Koska. Crying Rock solemnly shook her head.
"No one is born in Ashrank."
And she stuck her dead chagger pipe between her teeth, as though that was her last word on the business.
"She knows the secret ways up there, though. And you'll need 'em too, because those dragon bastards won't be extending no warm welcomes once you're on their ground. It's some strange sulphurous ground they've got, but they're jealous about it as mean bears, that's the truth."
"Then the two of you would be an invaluable addition to our expedition," said Koska. "What would be your terms?"
"We'd settle for a 20th share of any valuables recovered."
"Our aim is to root out rebellion, not valuables."
Sweet smiled.
"There's a risk of disappointment in any venture."
"Then welcome aboard. My notary will prepare an agreement."
274,
mused Friendly. His dead eyes drifted to Temple.
"And you?"
Koska began to slosh out drinks.
"Why are all the really interesting people always advanced in years?"
He nudged Temple in the ribs.
"Your generation really isn't producing the goods."
"We cower in giants' shadows and feel our shortcomings most keenly."
"Oh, you've been missed, Temple. If I've learned one thing in 40 years of warfare, it's that you have to look on the funny side. The tongue on this man. Conversationally, I mean, not sexually. I can't vouch for that. Don't include that, Sawbreck."
The biographer sullenly crossed something out.
"We shall leave as soon as the men are rested and supplies gathered."
"Might be best to wait till winter's passed," said Sweet.
Koska leaned close.
"Do you have any notion what will happen if I leave my company quartered here for 4 months? The state of the place now barely serves as a taster."
"You got any notion what'll happen if 300 men get caught in a real winter storm up there?"
grunted Sweet, pulling his fingers through his beard.
"None whatsoever," said Koska. "But I can't wait to find out. We must seize the moment. That has always been my motto. Note that down, Sawbreck."
Sweet raised his brows.
"Might not be long till your motto is, I can't feel my fucking feet."
But the Captain General was, as usual, not listening.
"I have a premonition we will all find what we seek in those mountains."
He threw one arm about Savian's shoulders and the other about Lamb's.
Lawson, his rebels, I, my gold, these worthy folk, their missing children. Let us toast our alliance.
And he raised Temple's nearly empty bottle high.
Shit on this, breathed Chai through gritted teeth.
Temple could only agree, but that appeared to be all his say in the matter. Nowhere to go. Ro pulled off the chain with the dragon scale and laid it gently on the furs. Chai once told her you can waste your life waiting for the right moment, now as good as any. She touched Pitt's cheek in the dark, and he stirred, the faintest smile on his face. He was happy here, young enough to forget, maybe. He'd be safe, or safe as he could be. In this world, there were no certainties. Ro wished she could say goodbye, but she was worried he'd cry. So she gathered her bundle and slipped out into the night. The air was sharp, snow gently falling, but melting as soon as it touched the hot ground, and dry a moment later. Light spilled from some of the houses, windows needing neither glass nor shutter, cut from the mountain, or from walls so old and weathered Ro couldn't tell them from the mountain. She kept to the shadows, rag-wrapped feet silent on the ancient paving, past the great black cooking slab, surface polished to a shine by the years, steam whispering from it as the snow fell. The longhouse door creaked as she passed, and she pressed herself against the pitted wall, waiting. Through the window she could hear the voices of the elders at their gathering. 3 months here, and she already knew their tongue.
"The Shanka are breeding in the deeper tunnels," Uto's voice. She always counseled caution.
"Then we must drive them out."
Akosh, she was always bold.
"If we send enough for that, there will be few left behind. One day, men will come from outside."
"We put them off in the place they call Beacon."
"Or we made them curious."
"Once we wake the dragon, it will not matter."
"It was given to me to make the choice,"
Werdenur's deep voice.
"The Maker did not leave our ancestors here to let his works fall into decay. We must be bold. Akosh, you will take 300 of us north into the deep places and drive out the Shanka and keep the diggings going over winter. After the thaw, you will return."
"I worry," said Uto. "There have been visions."
"You always worry."
Their words faded into the night as Ro padded past over the great sheets of dulled bronze where the names were chiseled in tiny characters, thousands upon thousands stretching back into the fog of ages. She knew Ikare was on guard tonight and guessed he would be drunk, as always. He sat in the archway, head nodding, spear against the wall, empty bottle between his feet. The dragon people were just people, after all, and each had their failings like any other. Ro looked back once and thought how beautiful it was, the yellow-lit windows in the black cliff face, the dark carvings on the steep roofs against a sky blazing with stars. But it wasn't her home. She wouldn't let it be. She scurried past Ikare and down the steps, hand brushing the warm rock on her right, because on her left, she knew, was 100 strides of empty drop. She came to the needle and found the hidden stair, striking steeply down the mountainside. It scarcely looked hidden at all, but Werdenur had told her that it had a magic, and no one could see it until they were shown it. Chai had always told her there were no such things as magi or demons, and it was all stories. But out here, in this far high corner of the world, all things had their magic. To deny it felt as foolish as denying the sky. Down the winding stair, switching back and forth, away from Ashrank, the stones growing colder underfoot. Into the forest,
great trees on the bare slopes, roots catching at her toes and tangling at her ankles. She ran beside a sulphurous stream, bubbling through rocks crusted with salt. She stopped when her breath began to smoke, the cold biting in her chest, and she bound her feet